Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, and I am joined today in a little unique twist that we don't get to do very often by our producer, Dan Humiston, who's filling in for Rob Hunt, who is out on the ski slopes in Utah on kid detail this afternoon. And we understand and hope that all goes well for him. And Rob will be back with us next week. Dan, nice to have you aboard today.
It's great to be here. I'm always on the other end of this, so it's nice to be able to chime in.
For sure. And we've got some interesting things to talk about. I know stuff that you've had some interest in. So we've got some very, very good news stories today. There's a lot going on in the marijuana world, most of which I would say is very, very positive. And that's always nice to be able to report on positive news, because Lord knows there's more than enough bad news. Once we get through all of that, we are going to be focusing today on the Grateful Dead's performance from January 10th, 1979 at the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York, out on Long Island. This is kind of a legendary venue for the Grateful Dead. I know Rob has seen them there a few times. I never made it out to Nassau and never had a chance to see them there, but they've played some historic shows there, not the least of which is this one on January 10th of 79, and then subsequently, as we all know, in 89 or 90, when they had Branford Marsalis join them on stage for what many would argue is the greatest version of Eyes of the World ever. And we've talked about that, and I'm sure we'll get back around to that one again someday, just because it's kind of hard to go any period of time without talking about it. But this is back in 1979. This is a real transition point for the Grateful Dead. It's kind of the end of the Donna and Keith era, just before the beginning of the Brent era. And it seems like, as you'll find out as we go through it more, the Dead are kind of shaking out the closet and, you know, cleaning things up as they get ready or anticipate this coming transfer. So I don't have to even introduce what this introductory clip we have that Dan's going to roll for us right now. So listen to it, and we'll talk about it in a second. That's just good stuff. First of all, St. Stephen is always fun to listen to. Second of all, this is a great version. And third of all, as we'll talk more about when we get to the show, this would be the last time that the Grateful Dead would play St. Stephen for 4 years, until October of 1983, when they played it three times, twice on the East Coast, once on the West Coast, and retired it forever. You know, for a song that was for such a long period of time, such an integral part of the Grateful Dead repertoire and an active song list, this really marked the end of a beginning for a tune like St. Stephen. But as you'll hear later on when we get to the show, there were a lot of other songs from back in the day that were able to make a comeback as well. So it's a great show, and stick around with us for a few minutes as we go through this marijuana stuff that we have to talk about. And we will get to the Grateful Dead shortly. So, Dan, as you know, there's lots of deals going on right now in the cannabis world, deals that are, you know, so large that, you know, sometimes they really kind of make you stop and, you know, do a double take. But this first story that we have is kind of significant, not because of the size of the deal. The numbers actually, by comparison to some of the other things we're going to be talking about today, aren't really so large or so huge. This isn't a $1 billion deal, a $975 million deal. What makes this news article here so significant is that it involves Scott's Miracle-Gro. And Scott's Miracle-Gro is a currently existing traditional company that has a huge market share of the home lawn care market. They also are one of the first traditional companies in the country to make such strong inroads into the cannabis world. They have a New York-based company called Hawthorne Gardening Company, which is a hydroponic business, and they also are becoming a major supplier of equipment for producers and cultivators in the cannabis market. as well as looking into their own potential cannabis holdings at some point in the future. What makes this story so interesting now for Scotts is that we see the way that, you know, big corporate America works as compared to everybody else, because the story starts by pointing out that they have, or they're expecting through their Hawthorne Gardening Company to experience a decline of about 40% in business this year because of a quote unquote slowdown in the cannabis market and supply chain disruptions. Now, the supply chain disruptions are familiar to all of us. Slowdown in the cannabis market, I guess, you know, I understand that overall, maybe on certain levels, certainly in states like Illinois and others that we've been talking about in the past with Rob and with Jim Marty, none of us have really seen significant slowdowns in our industry. But nevertheless, Scotts Miracle-Gro is saying, yeah, we're going to be experiencing a decline of about 40% of our business in the cannabis market. But at the very same time, they're moving to expand their cannabis holdings by purchasing a company called Lux Lighting for $215 million and a company called True Liberty Bags for $10 million. So Lux is a leading provider of lighting systems for growers. True Liberty provides liners and other storage solutions for dry and cure cannabis plants. And here's Scotts, which is headquartered in Ohio, has certainly made its name and its living in the home lawn care. This is significant. Not only are they active in the market, but even in the face of a decline of about 40% of business in their primary cannabis entity, they're still looking to expand, which can only be positive and has to suggest that these guys are looking at the market long term and are excited about that. And in fact, they go on to say that Scotts is expecting that the Lux brand that they've just purchased will add up to $100 million in sales on an annualized basis, which plans to market and distribute the brand up and down the East Coast and some of the emerging cannabis markets. So, you know, this is the way big corporate America operates, Dan. You know, they don't view it and say, wow, things are drying up. They view it and say, we're going to move hard and be ready for when things loosen up again and people are looking for large quantities of marijuana.
Yeah. Well, you know, this kind of builds off of a story that happened back in August that I don't know if it kind of flew under the radar, but there was a branch of Canopy Growth, the large Canadian cannabis company, was called Canopy River, and that was their capital company, and that was, they used that to do acquisitions, and it was, I think it was sort of an arm's length relationship. Well, Canopy River divested their relationship with Canopy Holdings or Canopy Growth and formed RIV or RIV Capital, so that they, and with the sole goal to create a MSO in the United States. So they're moving out of Canada and they're moving into the United States. And one of their first investors were Scotts Miracle-Gro through their subsidiary Hawthorne. They put $150 million into that fund. So there's a lot of pieces of this puzzle that if you're looking at it too closely, you don't see them. But if you can pull back a little bit, you can see Scotts Miracle-Gro has a lot of interest in this industry. And just by the fact that they, you know, they see a 40% drop, but that doesn't even slow them down a bit. And you know, they got a lot invested in this. And it's really exciting for us because finally, you know, the outside companies are like, we got to take a chance. We're going to go in this. We're all in.
That's true. And, you know, and it's great to see that, you know, this is just another big step in the road to normalization that people can look to and say, you know, I mean, Ohio is, you know, has its conservative roots, certainly, you know, although it also has its pro-marijuana advocates as well. But when you get a company that's based, you know, in that part of the country that becomes so successful and, you know, big and then decides that it wants to expand into this cannabis stuff, that just adds so much credibility to the industry, you know, in places where people, you know, who are big Scotts Miracle fans, but not necessarily marijuana fans, now stop and say, hey, look, you know, hopefully what they're going to say, right, is, look, you know, Scotts is into it. You know, they wouldn't be getting into something if it wasn't good. So, you know, I like to think that it's a positive move. And, you know, as long as they're not forcing mom and pop shops out of business, which they don't seem to be doing yet, then I, you know, only see this as a plus for the industry. And, you know, as more big companies start to be willing to put their name behind products in this industry, it's going to make things much easier to normalize and get investment dollars for the smaller businesses.
Good news. What else we have?
Okay, well, another one that we have, and this is interesting as well, because we have the Edmonton, Alberta-based company Aurora Cannabis that is doing business, interestingly enough, with Israel. And the business that they're doing with Israel is they are shipping medical marijuana to Israel. Because, as it turns out, Israel is one of the fastest expanding medical marijuana markets in the world. They have had medical marijuana for a while, and now the program is expanding to allow more people in. They don't have adult use in Israel yet, so a lot of people are going at it through the medical marijuana angle. Israel has become, one of a very small number of meaningful import markets for the medical cannabis world. It's nice that Aurora CEO Miguel Martin is very positive about this and sees this as being able to expand, hopefully, adult use cannabis across Europe and maybe even into markets like Israel as well. But the numbers for Israel are amazing, considering that the population of the country is maybe somewhere right around 5 or 6 million. Maybe it's more than that now, but not significantly. But there were 108,000 active medical cannabis patients in Israel in November of 21. And this makes Israel one of the biggest centrally regulated medical markets in the world. And that's up 30% from the year before, when they only had 76,000 registered patients. So Israel is an exploding market. I was there for their one of the first ever cannabis conferences they had there in April a few years ago. And although I've been to Israel a number of times with family and camp and things like that, as a return to the Jewish homeland and to visit family and friends, to actually go there for a cannabis conference was a pretty amazing experience. And it's just great to see that the market is so strong that they're reaching out. And it's always great to see that there's countries that are willing to do business with Israel and help them with their market. I think the real question is, at what point will Israeli cultivation be up and running to a point where they don't need to be making these purchases from outside the country? They can be supplying them from where in. And it's going to be interesting, because what the article points out is that dried flower, as we refer to it, flower accounts for 89.2% of all approved cannabis treatments in Israel, meaning it's a predominantly dry flower market, and extracts, which account for just about the other 10%, have seen very little growth. But, by my way of knowing and understanding Israelis and Israeli sensibilities, I think that just makes more sense to them as well. If you've always been a marijuana smoker and you smoke flower, sometimes it's kind of hard, to really grasp the extract. And it doesn't smoke as well. You can't roll joints, you can't do things like that with it. So, but it's just really, really nice here to see, Israel factoring in a significant way into the international cannabis market.
Yeah, the other thing that's really exciting is that the larger companies in Canada, they took a pretty good beating, because I think they overplayed the fact that Canada was an export country. And while that's such a great benefit, it only is a great benefit if there's an import company out there willing to take your stuff. And at the time, there really wasn't. So this is a real shot in the arm for the Canadian market and a lot of the Canadian companies that have been kind of struggling, because there really wasn't any place for them to send their excess capacity. And now this is an opportunity. And if it goes well with Israel, then, like you said, some of the other European markets may open up for import. And that will be a real boost for the entire all the Canadian companies, and a lot of the shareholders can finally start to see some of their value come back.
Yeah, that would be great. And, there are a lot of people, a lot of Americans who've invested in those Canadian companies and have lost money. And if there's a way to revitalize those companies, both for the good of the Canadian program, the international markets, and the investors, then that really is a win-win for everyone, and really works out well. So we'll see what happens with that. But I have to say, and you and I were talking about this before we started taping today, as big and significant as both of those matters are, as we talked about, the one that really kind of made us stop and do a double take is that MJ Biz has been acquired by a company called Emerald X, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Emerald's Holding, which is a New York-based business-to-business event and media company, for $120 million in cash, plus potential earnouts, which says here could be worth as much as another $20 to $50 million. Now, this is just amazing because MJ Biz were one of the first guys on the scene when this all began. They started the MJ BizCon. The one we were at in 2013, Dan, in Seattle, I think was the second one ever. They had had one the year before in Denver that I think they said drew about somewhere between 70 and 100 participants. As I recall, we had about 600 people at ours. And now we saw the numbers for this one this past November, you know, more or less still in the midst of a COVID pandemic. And it looks like they had almost 30,000 people at that one. I know the last one I was at a couple of years ago, they had over 40,000 people. So these guys have just really done an absolutely, you know, amazing job. You know, Chris Walsh and Cassandra Farrington and Ann Holland and you know, the job these guys have done in promoting themselves and getting out there. And I usually throw credit out as we're going along, but knowing we'd get to this story today, MJ Biz is the primary source for most of the news stories that we report on and we talk about. And, you know, we find the quality of their stories, the timing, and the interest levels all to be, you know, very, very well suited for the type of audience that we're trying to reach. And as far as we go, things that interest us and our client bases and everything that we're doing. And I've gotten to know Chris and Cassandra a little bit over the years. Cassandra was in Israel at the conference that I attended, and just couldn't be happier to see this work out so well for them, in terms of, you know, really kind of cementing their place as one of the founders of the cannabis mass media market. And I know you've had some experience with them, Dan, particularly in your former life as a show promoter for Cannabis World Congress. So, you know, to you, this type of a deal must have a real special resonance to it.
Well, it validates I started the Cannabis World Congress Business Expo in, our first show was right after their show in Seattle. So we did one in Las Vegas in June of 2014, so about 6 months after their show in Seattle. And I remember at the time, so many people saying, well, why are you doing this? Why would people want to go to this? And I, you know, you just knew it was a good idea. It was, and to their credit, I mean, I guess you'd consider them competitors, but I never really felt like there was a competition, because, you know, they had their markets, we had ours, but they're real professional. They were always professional, always, you know, just real approachable, good people. And even back in the day when George Gage was running their shows, he was, you know, another real good, real professional guy. He's got a new cannabis convention called, the name escapes me right now, but it was in Las Vegas at the same time this past year. Oh, just a quality group of people, and that's the people that you want to see win. Like, those are the people that you want to see win. And then back to our former point, again, you're bringing in a non-cannabis group is spending significant dollars to get into the cannabis industry. Significant dollars to get into the cannabis industry. It just validates what we're all doing, what we all believed. All those years later, we can sit there and say, we were right. We knew it. We were right. I don't know if that gets us anything, but that's what makes you feel better, that, you know, that we were right.
Well, you were right. And you know, and MJ Biz has just done a great job. They talked about how MJ Biz's revenues in 2021 were approximately $27 million, which they say was pretty much their pre-pandemic levels as well. So they really put together a great business plan and an idea for how they were going to take their way through this pandemic, and obviously succeeded. The good news for those of us that still rely very much on them as a source of our cannabis news and who enjoy being able to attend MJ BizCon is that the current leadership team and staff is going to continue under the new ownership. As we all know, and Dan, you from experience as well, how important that is to maintain that continuity of ownership. It's you know, with all due respect to the new owners, that's great and good luck to them, but you know, it's the George Gages and the Walshes and the Farringtons of the world who you know, ultimately have the ability to develop these types of businesses, to really take them to the next level and really make them something special. And as they do it, I think they're just demonstrating the role that the cannabis industry plays in this country's economy. You know, this has become must-read material for folks inside and out of the industry who want to know what's going on. Their conference has become, you know, the event of the year. If you go to one cannabis conference a year, you go to MJBiz, that's where you're going to see the most people. That's where you're going to get the most networking done. And that's a real credit to them. And by allowing this current leadership team and staff to remain in place, you know, Emerald, I think, is just showing smart business sense, because this team has already been successful. Why rock the apple cart at this point? But for those of us who deal with these folks, it's nice to know that they're not going away.
Yeah, hopefully their publication remains in the same, whoever's leading that, whether it's Chris Walsh or whoever's in charge of the editorial, maybe it's Ann Holland. It's her company. I don't know. I've never met Ann Holland, but I know that it's her company that this all started under. So I'm sure she's heavily involved with it, but you got to hope that same team stays involved, because they provide really great content.
They do. And the good news of all of this is that they've already announced MJ BizCon for 2022. So it's never too early to start thinking about what you're going to be doing 11 months from now. And November 15th through the 18th in Las Vegas, which I like, because that's back to their kind of traditional week before Thanksgiving week schedule that they had maintained for a number of years, and is much better suited for a lot of us than when they shifted the dates around 1 year into December and 1 year back to October. So I'm glad to see that they're back to this traditional time slot, and I'm certainly going to make an effort on my part to find myself back out there and taking advantage of that.
I just remembered that George Gage's cannabis conference in Las Vegas was called MJ Unpacked, and that was a nice twist. It was a little bit smaller, but it was another great one. So it just goes to show there's room for everybody in that space.
There really is, and you know, people just have to be patient and look for the right opportunity. So this is a good day of marijuana news. A lot of great business deals going on in the industry at prices that reflect real value, and people really accepting this industry as coming along, and it's always nice to see when, you know, one of the original companies has an opportunity to cash out at a price that justifies the value that they've brought to the industry. So again, congratulations to our folks at MJ Biz, and thank you for being the source of our news stories. You make us look good, so we're glad that you do well also. Shifting over to our musical side, what we want to talk about today is the Grateful Dead. I don't want it to go unnoticed that between the last time we taped and today was New Year's Eve. And even though you guys hear our shows a couple of days later, sometimes it works out well. Sometimes it can be a little bit more distracting, and certainly fish in the sense that, you know, by the time everyone listens to this podcast, the New Year's Eve show is already 10 days old. But I just think that it has to be mentioned how they were able to put this together in this ninth cube idea, and the opportunity to actually be able to listen to live fish. And, you know, I think it's always going to a certain degree lack the energy you get when you have a huge crowd screaming behind you as you break into tunes that everyone desperately wants to hear. But these guys do a really, really good job in this type of a situation. There was a lot of lighthearted banter and other stuff going on, and I think they really had a good time. And it made a really nice evening for all of us, especially those of us whose football teams lost on New Year's Eve. I'm still a big Go Blue fan, but the Dogs had their day. But afterwards, to be able to just go and tune into fish for a while was very enjoyable, and a nice way to bring the emotions from the not very hard fought game back to a normal level. So hats off to fish for doing what they do best, and that's just creating fun for people and living up to the moments.
Larry, was the Fish concert, did that roll right through New Year's on the East Coast, or was it, did it end before the stroke of 12?
No, it did. The show started, I want to say, at 8:30 East Coast time, and they actually played three full sets like they would have if they had been playing in Madison Square Garden. So timing-wise, it took them through New Year's Eve, yes.
Oh, that's kind of neat. So you could have had that playing in the background during your party. That's great, yeah. What a good idea. You know, it's for a lot of people that could, it'd be kind of cool if they simulcast their concerts on New Year's Eve, because like I said, you'd have that playing in the background or you could play that music could be playing during your New Year's Eve party. That'd be fun.
Yeah, it does. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, they do it. I mean, the Dead did it for years and years on, you know, regular commercial radio, because that's all there was. But, you know, the big rock stations in Chicago would always, you know, fight over who was going to get to play the Grateful Dead's New Year's show from California. And it used to be on a network, I think, called Westwood One. And they did it, but, you know, they would pick it up every year. And of course, you know, timing wise, it was always a little awkward, because the Dead would typically come on at New Year's Eve around 10 o'clock in the evening, which was already midnight in Central Time and 1 a.m. on the East Coast. So by the time they were counting down to midnight, we were at 2 a.m. And if we stayed up to listen to the whole show, it would sometimes run until 4 or 5 a.m. But, you know, once kids came along, you know, dashing off to all of those shows never was much of an option anymore, at least not in the short run. So it was nice to be able to have something to fall back on and still be able to catch some of the shows. So Fish is just kind of carrying on a proud tradition there, I think, and it's nice to see. And although the fans are disappointed they didn't get to go see them live, this is certainly the next best thing. The other big musical event is problematic going in the other direction, because between the time Dan and I are taping this today and when you listen to this on January 10th, the first weekend of Playing in the Sand will have transpired down in Mexico. And this is all very interesting, because it is scheduled for this weekend and then the following weekend. And I know they completely sold out. In fact, they sold out on their just providing tickets to all the people that had been to shows at Playing in the Sand in the past and were given the first option. I think that pretty much sold them out before they even really got to the public. But of course, with everything that's going on now with Omicron numbers and concerns over traveling and leaving the country, I was wondering, you know, whether the shows were still going to be on, whether they would consider postponing them like Fish did with New Year's Eve, or what might happen. Of course, you come to realize that Playing in the Sand is a little bit more detailed, and they're booked into these resorts with these special rooms and all sorts of stuff that they get. And, you know, if you try and do it 3 or 4 months later, the stuff is all booked up through the season. And I guess this is their only way to do it. It's a lot of money that would all have to be refunded. But hey, look, you know, if they're going to put into place protocols like they say they're going to have for testing and vaccine and all of that, you know, then I suppose, you know, if it's a risk people want to take, God bless them. And you know, go ahead and do it. I did hear that they are offering full refunds for folks who are about, you know, nervous about doing that kind of traveling, which is interesting, but the right thing to do. And we will hopefully all know more, because our intrepid former host, Jim Marty, I can't remember if he said if he was going to the shows this weekend or next weekend, but he will be down there for one round of the shows for sure. And we will be very excited to hear from Jim when he gets back. He'll call in and give us an update on how it all went down, both musically and procedurally, whether they got that all taken care of. So lots of fun things going on in the Dead world.
Yeah, you were talking about going down there like a year ago. We were kind of, you know, we actually, I think we even talked about doing our podcast down there, but, you know, things just too unsettled right now. There's just too unsettled.
Yeah, you know, I applaud anyone who says, you know, that they feel comfortable going down there. By all means, go and enjoy yourself. If you're going to go look for a place to escape for a little while during the pandemic, dancing on the sand with the Grateful Dead is a pretty good place to be. And, you know, I mean, if the band is okay with it, then God bless them. You know, hopefully they'll all do it the right way and everybody will come out of there having had a great time and all very healthy. But we will get updates and we will report on that as we go along. So today is January 10th. Quick birthday shout out to my brother Steven, who was born January 10th in 1969. So he's getting up there in age now too. I've gone to many a Dead show with him. We will keep each other advised as to when the latest box sets are being released, so that neither one of us misses it. But he has a January 10th birthday, so I hope he has a great day, and a shout out to him. January 10th, 1979, the Grateful Dead played at the Nassau County Coliseum. We talked about that a little bit before. We heard on the intro the clip from St. Stephen, which was the last time they played St. Stephen until October of 1983. And for me, the cool thing about that is I was at the show in Madison Square Garden in October of 1983 when they broke St. Stephen out again for the first time since that show in NASA. And that was my 10th Grateful Dead show I ever saw. And out of about 110 or more so that I ultimately saw And I still probably have to say that, you know, it was the most exciting, you know, kind of hair-raising moment ever for me at a Grateful Dead show. And I was there when Phil broke out Box of Rain in Hampton. And that was 86, I think, 86 or 87. And that was a huge moment. I was at the Greek Theater 20th anniversary shows in 1985 when they broke out That's It for the Other One, which was a great moment. But St. Stephen was really kind of the lifeblood of the band, and it was it had a status far beyond many of the other Dead songs. And I think that was just a spillover. We talk about the Primal Dead back in the late 1960s, and St. Stephen was a major part of that. The Dead's standard suite of tunes back then was Dark Star into St. Stephen, into The Eleven, into Love Light, with Pigpen going off on that forever and ever. Love Light survived over the years with Bobby ultimately picking up the mantle and singing it. Dark Stars, we'll talk about in a minute, made its way in and out of the Dead repertoire after the heydays of the late 60s and the early 70s. The 11 just pretty much got dropped altogether, and that's very unfortunate. And not until Phil and Friends and the other ones and now Dead & Co. came around and really picked it back up again. But St. Stephen was one of those tunes that people just went to shows forever trying to see, and nobody could understand how such a standard song like that, that was so important to the fans, was never played again. And I've never really heard a very satisfactory answer to it. Jerry's dead, so we can't ask him. We have what we have. But the significance of this show in 1979 is it really does mark this transition of the Dead saying, we've played the hell out of St. Stephen over the last 10 or whatever years, and enough with that for a while. We need to move in another direction. We need our fans to be digging us for other tunes. But just to show that they're, you know, equal opportunity about that, you have to remember that this show that we're talking about right now, January 10th, 1979, is just 10 days, really 9 days, after the New Year's Eve show that we were talking about a week or two ago, the Farewell to Winterland. And when we closed out that show, we played the Countdown to Midnight as kind of our lead out, and, you know, for everyone to lead into their New Year's celebrations. But one of the significant parts of that show that night was that the Dead played their first Dark Star in 4 years. The last time they had played it was October 18th, 1974, and then at Winterland in the Farewell on the night of December 31st, which is misleading because the show really started at midnight, so the bulk of it was played, if not all of it, was played on January 1st of 1979 in the early morning hours. But the Dead broke out another Dark Star there. And, of course, the significance of that Dark Star is this is now the first Dark Star on the East Coast in 4 years. When they had played it 10 nights earlier at the Winterland, that was out in San Francisco. So, of course, all the New York fans had heard about it by that point. And very, very many of them were likely very excited and anticipating it. And as a result, I was tempted to play a clip right at the very beginning of the show. At the beginning of now, when we dive into it, at the beginning of the song Dark Star, just to hear the crowd react. And while it is wonderful and great to hear the crowd react, we're really here to hear the music of it. And so I think we've got a good clip here for Dan to run for us of this Dark Star. This is the first East Coast Dark Star in 4 years on January 10th, 1979. Dark Star, you can recognize it a mile away. You can hear the crowd. This is already mid-song, and they're still screaming and yelling. And, you know, Dark Star was probably the spiritual core of the Grateful Dead. You know, St. Stephen was maybe the most standard song and traditional song you could sing along with. Dark Star is not really designed for people to sing along with. There's only two verses. They're kind of short and choppy. Sometimes Jerry muddles his way through them. Sometimes he just blows them off altogether and just likes to play the music. So people talk about seeing Dark Star, but a Dark Star jam, or Dark Star, but they only played verse one, or they only sang, you know, verse two. So, you know, this is a full blown Dark Star. Start first verse, second verse, long jams. And, you know, it for new Deadheads, it might take a little while to really understand and get into the full significance of a Dark Star. But the first time you're at a show and, you know, you're trying some psychedelics and the Grateful Dead break off into one of these, you know, 18 to 20 minute Dark Stars, you know, even the ones that they did subsequent. And they did play some intermittently off and on after that, once or twice in the 80s, the late 1980s. They broke them out. They broke it out sporadically through the 90s. They seemed to have a real liking for RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. in a couple of summers in a row. They played it there. I think they played one at Giants Stadium. And ultimately, the last Dark Star ever played was on March 30th, 1994 in Atlanta. And, you know, that was the day that it got retired. And, you know, Jerry never brought it back. And just a little bit more than a year later, he was dead. And that was the end of the band. So it's kind of nice, though, when you think about it, how it really marks the symmetry that here, with not just even the same show, but the same set of music, the Dead are playing their last St. Stephen for 4 years and their first Dark Star in 4 years. And, you know, a true Deadhead might say, well, for God's sakes, boys, why aren't you playing them together like you used to do in the late 60s? And let's really get that magic rolling again. They had become such a different band by this point than they were in the late 1960s. They had just had the whole 1970s and all of their songwriting and all of these albums that came out, many of which we've talked about, not the least of which was American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, and the way that they kind of adopted this Americana style of music and really adapted to the different eras that they were in. And yet here, you know, all the Deadheads want to hear is Dark Star and St. Stephen. And, you know, I think it speaks a lot to the power of those tunes that, you know, Deadheads who, many Deadheads, in fact, Rob is one of them. By the time he started seeing the Dead, they had already done the 83 St. Stephens and never played them again. And there are, you know, few people who saw the Dead as many times in the 90s, at least than I know, as our co-host Rob Hunt, but he never got it. Although he did get a few Dark Stars and other things, so I don't really feel too bad for him. He got plenty of good stuff, as did we all. If you saw enough shows, you always got more than you knew what to do with. But that's just, you know, the vagaries of going to the Grateful Dead show. And that is exactly the thing that would drive people to Dead shows again and again and again. What if tonight's the night that they decide to do Dark Star and St. Stephen in the same set for the first time in who knows how many years? And there it was. So it was a really great part of that show, and really, really fun to hear, I'm sure, for people who were there.
Larry, I'm always curious about this. You know, we just take for granted, because we have the internet, that, you know, information just travels almost instantly. But how, first off, how did you know that they hadn't played St. Stephen's in, you know, a length of time? And I guess the next question, a follow-up, is how long had it gone before people started to realize that it had, like, I mean, I guess if you have one or two shows, people are like, oh, no big deal. If it's like 50 shows, at what point did people start to recognize that it's not playing? And then how did you guys know?
You know, it's funny, as we sit here and we talk about it and we take for granted that I can just go on the internet right now and call up any of this information in 30 seconds or less and have it all right in front of my face. You know, what was the last time the Grateful Dead played St. Stephen? Click, boom, here it is. How many times did they play it? Boom, here it is. And the truth of the matter is this is part of what made the Grateful Dead so cool and so interesting to me, is that there's this whole culture that was so heavily focused on the music and the spontaneous nature of it. And so when anything is spontaneous, what it's really telling you is the band's playing anything they want to play. So the songs that they're playing must be the songs that they want to play. And it went, well, why don't they want to play St. Stephen now? They played it before and we all used to hear it. It was all great. But, you know, the new Deadheads in the early 1980s hadn't had a chance to hear it, and you know, people were, you know, a little bummed out. There'd always be a little grassroots movement, but the Dead, there was lots of ways to know what was going on. At some point in the mid 1980s, these guys came up with a 1-800 telephone number called Run USA Dead or something, and you would type, you after a show was over, usually about 20 minutes after a show was over, you could call in, and sometimes you'd get a busy signal, sometimes you wouldn't, and basically you'd listen to a guy read the set list. and he'd read it really slowly so you could write it down while he was doing it, because people complained that if you read it too fast, they had to call back in a second time to get the set list. But that was one way, you know, to find immediately. But a song like St. Stephen was so well known and so popular, and Deadheads were always traveling all over the place, that yes, at some point, you know, probably I would guess within a month or so, people were probably noticing, gee, you know, we haven't heard of St. Stephen. When was the last St. Stephen? And certainly by the time they got to their next tour after this tour was over, you know, if it hadn't been brought back, you know, then it starts getting talked about. But it's the kind of thing that the Deadheads pass on to one another. And I learned all of this going to shows with my buddies who are all big Deadheads and just sitting around and listening to them talk. You know, or we'd be, you know, over at somebody's house listening and saying, oh, yeah, this is a great version of St. Stephen. And I, you know, gee, you know, do they ever even play St. Stephen? No, man, they haven't played it in, you know, since, you know, since January 10th, 1979, dude. That was the last time it was. And then, you know, you hear it from a few other people. And eventually, I mean, I had no way to independently verify it, right? I couldn't go back and check set lists until the first version of Dead Bass, which was the first official compilation of set lists of Grateful Dead shows that really went through and compiled them all. But my recollection is that was already, we're talking mid to late 80s, but, you know, even back in the 70s and, you know, right from the beginning, the Grateful Dead music just attracted the kind of people who, you know, Rob says it really well, you know, music nerds, people who love the music, but it's more than just the music. And that's why, you know, and I know we've beat this comparison to death on this show and people do all the time, but it compares really well to baseball, you know, and it's just that kind of thing, because every time you go to a show, something's going to be different. You know, something's going to be different. So record keeping becomes really, really important. And the people who choose to do the record keeping, like Dick Latvala and now David Lemieux, who do the From the Vaults albums and are the ones who, you know, really, you know, go back and follow all of this stuff and kind of keep it going. And that's just the way that this band, but it's not just, you know, now Fish and all of these bands, you know, there's always, it's a hierarchy, but not a hierarchy in terms of who has more power. It's a hierarchy in terms of who has more knowledge, more firsthand knowledge. You know, and it's one thing to say, oh, man, I'm listening to this show, you know, from this bar mitzvah party in St. Louis, and it's kind of cool. And then it's another thing to talk, we did a couple of weeks ago, to talk to Mark Schlossberg, a guy who was actually there. You know, and now you're hearing the firsthand account of what really went down. And for Deadheads, you know, many of us at least, we soak that up like sponges because, you know, we live and die with all of this little oh, that's so interesting. They did that. And then, you know, guys will even take it deeper and try and use that to show connections to, well, they were playing this song that way at that time, and this must have been the factors that were influencing them. Or, you know, there's deep studies that go into all of this stuff that gets a little too deep and scholarly for guys like me. But yeah, that's just what always made the Dead great from the beginning, was this idea of spontaneity. You know, you don't know what you're going to get, but you're sure that whatever you get, you're going to like it. And yeah, you know, there was enough of us who saw enough shows over the years that eventually you kind of get jaded and you're like, oh man, they're playing Little Red Rooster again. You know, the point is right now today, you know, any Grateful Dead fan I know, you know, would give their two front teeth to see Jerry Garcia and the Dead play Little Red Rooster one more time. So, you know, we take them as we get them. But yeah, this is always what's been so special about the Grateful Dead and really drew us in on all of this. And, you know, this is just one of those shows that, you know, again, I highly recommend, you know, to our listeners, you know, to go out. You can find it on archive.org. The entire set list is just, you know, so amazing to me. And even, you know, as a later day Deadhead with the Dead shows that I was used to going to see, you know, when you can get a second set at a Grateful Dead show that basically starts with Shakedown Street and I Need a Miracle, Bertha, Good Lovin', Dark Star, then into the drums, then Space, then into a Wonderful Wharf Rat, then into the last St. Stephen they're going to play, a little Chuck Berry at the end. To me, you know, that's a great show on any level when you can get a set list like that and how well they've played it here. But, you know, you throw in this special history of their last St. Stephen, their first Dark Star for long periods of time. And, you know, what's so wonderful, you know, is with all of these tunes going back and forth, as you'll hear in a minute when we sign off and we play for the outro of our show a little segment from Shakedown Street, which at that time was just beginning to take off. The album was released in, I think, late 77, early 78. They were calling it Disco Dead. We've talked about St. Stephen, about Shakedown Street on this show a lot. But, you know, this is a Shakedown Street that's played with all the energy and excitement that you would expect from that tune, but especially when it was still so fresh for the Dead and for their fans. And, you know, to be able to be there at a moment as, you know, the Dead are kind of still figuring out what they're doing with St. Stephen and Dark Star, which have been part of their repertoire for so long. And then there's so many new songs that are just, you know, people at the time were like, oh, yeah, this is that Shakedown Street. And I'm sure people loved it, but, you know, it still didn't hold a candle yet, you know, to songs like Dark Star and St. Stephen. But yet, you know, we're going to hear it here in a minute, and it's just so great that, to me, it really makes this a special show and one that people should really take a moment to listen to, because you just get this great meeting point of so many different directions in the Grateful Dead history. It's really a lot of fun.
You know, Larry, I want to remind our listeners that we always have the links to the shows that we're playing clips from in the show notes. So if you're listening to the show and you're like, hey, you know what, I'd love to listen to that show, we have the link to archive.org, to the show that we're previewing right in the show notes. So just go in there and click the link and you'll be able to listen to the show.
Excellent. Even better. Then you won't have to try and figure out how to get there like I do, and I need my kids to do it for me. But yeah, great show. And Dan, that's all I got for today. Great to have you on the talking side of the microphone for a change. Always nice to be able to catch up and, you know, get to hear your stories and remind everyone that, you know, you're far from a novice in this industry and well, and, you know, you date back as far as I do and have had some amazing accomplishments on your own. So it's always nice to have you share some of that with us and with the listeners.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, although I'm looking forward to Rob getting back. And also looking forward to Jim's review from Playing in the Sand. I think I mean, we have a lot of exciting stuff coming up, and not to mention a lot of great guests. So 2022 is going to be a lot of fun on the Deadhead Cannabis Show.
I think so. You know, it's already off to a roaring start. We've had a couple of great episodes already. This is going to be a fun one, I think, for people to listen to. And you're right. With the combination of Rob Hunt, you know, really moving in now and everything else that's been going on, we are really looking forward to great things for this podcast in this upcoming year and hope that all of our listeners will be along for the ride. So then until next week, goodbye, everyone. Have a safe and healthy week. Enjoy yourselves and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. And now enjoy a little bit of Shakedown Street from January 10th, 1979. Thanks.